This is the sixth week I've taught. We kind of skipped a week there a couple weeks ago. So this is actually the sixth week I've taught. And last week we talked about naturalism. We talked about responding to naturalists, basically people who do not believe in God or any supernatural entities. They believe that the universe is all there is, basically. As soon as the projector comes up, I'll review a few points. I mean, it's on projector mode on my end, yeah.
Power it off, all the way off.
Justified true belief. And that's not my definition. That's the technical philosophical definition of knowledge. It's probably one of the... Well, in simplest layman's terms, your justification for a belief is your reason for believing it. And obviously, that's where most of the debate lies. Most philosophers, no matter what stripe you are, and everyone's a philosopher, by the way. You don't have to get a degree in philosophy to be a philosopher. You are a philosopher just by virtue of the fact that you're human. And every philosopher understands, knows that knowledge is justified true belief. You have to assent to certain beliefs, assent to those propositions, and they need to be true, and you need to have reasons for believing them. But obviously, there's huge disagreement over what a sufficient reason is. And that's where we get into, you know, empiricists, people who think if I can't experience something with my five senses, it can't really be true. It can't really be real. And then you have, on the other hand, say a Christian who believes that revelation from God is a sufficient source of knowledge, a reason. The fact that it's from God, that is the reason it is true. It should be believed because it, who it came from, the source it came from. And my the point I tried to emphasize a couple weeks ago is that everybody, at the end of the day, is whenever they make a knowledge claim, is going to make an appeal to something. It's either going to be, I think, ultimately to themselves, to their own wisdom, or to God. And I think that's supported by Scripture. If you look in Proverbs, there's basically two contrasting epistemologies presented. Foolishness and wisdom. And no matter what individual worldview you look at, whether it's Buddhism, Islam, secularism, it doesn't matter. It's either going to reduce to wisdom or foolishness at the end of the day. Oh, nice. All right. So last week, we talked about naturalism. I'll give a brief review of that. This week, we're going to talk about a concept that's closely related to secularism and is probably more familiar to a lot of you, and that's secularism. especially if you're into politics. This might be the most politically oriented lesson I do, for better or for worse. So anyway, last week we talked about naturalism, the idea that the supernatural does not exist, and I wanted to give you an idea of how to respond to naturalists based on some of the theoretical groundwork we laid in the first few lessons. And I believe the quote I kept giving to kind of present the gist of naturalism was the one by Carl Sagan, who said the cosmos is all that is, was, and ever will be. I found this other quote from a gentleman named Peter Angelis that I have not included yet, but I wanted to do it now. He said, "Without God, what is left? Man and the universe. That should be enough. That has to be enough because that is all there is." So that's another great example of somebody espousing naturalism. It is just matter. It is just the material universe and what we experience in it. And there's nothing outside of that. No angels, demons, heaven, hell, gods, etc. So we talked last week about how you can't really prove that nature is all that exists. It's just impossible to prove. So what the naturalist will generally end up doing is just making the assertion that naturalism is true and then mocking Christianity. But usually if you talk to a naturalist, you talk to a hardened atheist or agnostic, they're going to spend most of their time just trying to attack, mock, make fun of Christianity. They don't want to spend a lot of time talking about their epistemology, their worldview, because it unravels pretty quickly. But as I've emphasized, we don't want to let them get away with that. We do want to talk to them about their worldview and its problems. Yes? Well, I mean, in the simplest sense of the word, proof is, actually, I probably should come up with a good term for proof to give in a class like this. I guess I'm relying on people's general understanding of the term here. I guess provide a good argument for it. They cannot provide a good argument for naturalism. And the reason I said it's impossible to prove is that if your epistemology only allows for the possibility that material things exist, like empiricism, you obviously can never use that epistemology to learn anything about non-empirical things, gods, angels, demons, heaven, hell. You're just precluded from understanding or knowing anything about that. Well, just because you have this epistemology that doesn't let you learn about that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. You're just at a dead end, and so you just have to assert, basically, that matter is all that exists. But you can pressure, if you pressure an atheist, for example, long enough, if they're honest, they'll admit, yeah, I don't actually know that God doesn't exist. I just don't think there's good enough reasons for believing God exists, which is really two different positions. Yeah, well, in this class in general, whenever I talk about proof and knowledge, I am talking about, I don't like the term absolute certainty for reasons I'm going to get into in another class, but if you wanted to say, yeah, sure, certain, I believe knowledge is, the technical term is infallible. It cannot be wrong. It has to be true. And for example, God's revelation cannot be false by virtue of who he is. He is omniscient, eternal, infallible. He cannot lie. That's what scripture says. So something he says cannot be false. That means whatever he comes out of his mouth is certainly true. There is no reason to doubt it. That's literally what certainty means, the absence of doubt. But, when we talk about just say like the weather or even something like you know, my family loves me, or, you know, I'm making a prediction about, say, your favorite sports team. People will use the term no colloquially, but really, do they have certainty? No, they don't have certainty. When I talk about knowledge in this class, I am talking about certainty. And I showed that clip last week of the Christian debating the atheist, and the Christian made quick work of the atheist. He pointed out how the atheist worldview was, or his epistemology was contradictory, how really he was stuck in this worldview where he couldn't know if anything existed outside of his own mind. And the Christian just pointed this out, reduced his position to absurdity. And what did the atheist do? He just started playing semantic games. He just started saying, you know, well, you can't be certain of things either, neither can I, so it's not really a big deal. These are dumb arguments. It was just a diversion tactic. It was just a way to escape the criticisms. And that's what I think naturalists, or whatever term you want to use, atheists, agnostics, eventually have to do. Otherwise, the discussion's over. And again, as I said, if you're ever having a discussion with an unbeliever and you just get it to the point where they admit that they are the authority, they admit that, yeah, I'm asserting things because I think they're true, I want them to be true, that's a good place to end the discussion. That's all that they need to admit. You're not going to obviously persuade them right there, probably, of the truth of Christianity, but at least you were able to silence them in a sense. And if there's other people watching, if there's other people there, that can be a powerful testimony, possibly, to them. A reminder that, you know, hey, Christianity can hold up in rational discourse, whereas these other worldviews cannot. So the main argument that I presented against naturalism last week, and actually I don't think we covered it in much depth because time ran out, it's called the evolutionary argument against naturalism. It was kind of popularized in recent years by a Christian philosopher named Alvin Plantinga. And it's a very clever argument, and it's similar to an argument that C.S. Lewis has used in some of his books. But basically, this is the argument presented against naturalism. As soon as you say to the naturalist, you know what, we're all just blobs of matter, are we not? And the naturalist would have to say, yeah, yeah, we really are. At the end of the day, we're just very evolved, advanced stardust. Or, you know, we're the result of this process of billions of years of evolution, and we just started out off as, you know, a few amino acids that turned into single-cell organisms, and a few billion years later, here we are. And you say, okay, well, if that's the case, you're stardust, I'm stardust. Seems like our opinions on truth are kind of arbitrary. What does the universe really care about what's true, what's right? At the end of the day, we're just stardust. We're just, you know, as I think one of the Christians I showed last week said, you know, you're fizzing atheism, I'm fizzing Christianity. That's just how we evolved. What does it matter? Well, the naturalist to that will respond, well, I can trust the reliability of my beliefs because if I didn't evolve to believe true things, I wouldn't, or my species would not have survived. Right? If you are a creature out in the wild, and you cannot think properly to flee from danger, find food, find shelter, etc., you're going to die. So obviously there has to be some extent to which I evolved to believe true things. So that's why I think, yeah, even though I'm ultimately just, you know, a collision of random chemicals, molecules, whatever, ultimately I'm just stardust, that's why I think my beliefs are somewhat reliable. Well, here's the problem. And this is, again, what Alvin Plantinga pointed out. He said, your survival, your ability to survive does not actually require you to believe true things, at least philosophically. You can believe lies, and they can actually still help you survive. you want an example in nature, it is possible that maybe there are some animals that think, if I touch any dead animal, I will become dead like that animal. Just like when I touch water, I become wet. When I touch something that's dead, I become dead. Therefore, I'm not going to touch dead things. Is that a true belief? No, that's not how it works. You don't touch something dead and become dead. You don't automatically inherit or take on its properties. But in believing that and not touching dead things, guess what? You might prevent yourself from ever getting a disease from corpses or whatever. And therefore, you actually do become more likely to survive. You actually have additional fitness. That'd be an example in nature. My favorite example is one that you can just use right then with the naturalist. You can say, wait a second, if we evolved to believe true things, why did so many humans evolve to believe in religion? Which is exactly your problem. You're standing here critiquing religion, talking about how stupid and absurd it is. And yet, according to you, the human species must have evolved to believe in religion because it has a value in survival. It creates group cohesion. It gives somebody hope who might otherwise have no hope. There's lots of psychological advantages to believing in religion. So right here, right there, we have what's called a defeater for your position. We have a reason to doubt this idea of yours that our brains, which evolved, are producing reliable beliefs. And what can the naturalist do? They can't step outside of their evolved mind and survey the situation and offer a critique. They're stuck. They're stuck in their evolved mind, and we've just established that it's possible that they evolved to believe philosophical lies. It's a dead end. That is, again, what we call a reductio ad absurdum, reduction to absurdity. And there's lots of naturalist philosophers that have tried to interact with this argument, but again, ultimately they have to just fall back on, well, I'm surviving, my life's going on, my beliefs are working for me. Position that doesn't really deal with the criticism. So again, that was the evolutionary argument against naturalism. And the reason I like these kind of arguments is that basically you learn one argument and you get good at one argument, and you don't have to memorize masses of, you know, scientific evidence, archaeological evidence, historical evidence. If you're more of a person that enjoys talking about evidences like that with unbelievers, more power to you. I'm not going to stop you. But there's a great quote actually from Immanuel Kant, the philosopher. He said, if someone comes to me with 10 arguments for his position, I know that he probably has no arguments for his position. Because if he had just one really good airproof argument, what would he need for the others? And that's kind of my position when I talk to people. It doesn't matter if I'm talking to a Mormon, an atheist, a Muslim. I usually just have one argument that I want to be really good at, and I want to just home in on that during the entire discussion. So we'll talk about Mormonism later and some of those other pseudo-Christian religions. But for example, with Mormonism, you know, I will not let them go off topic. I will just keep the discussion on one point, and that is basically, what is the gospel? What does it mean to be saved? Because Mormonism has 1,001 little weird doctrines and ideas that you could get bogged down on. And at the end of the day, some of them might be heretical. Some of them might not be. Like, I remember one time I was talking to some Mormon missionaries over the course of maybe an hour or two. And toward the end of the discussion, we got really bogged down talking about whether the Mormon belief that there's 3 levels of heaven is true, is real. And they pull this idea from just one passage in Scripture. And afterward, I realized that was a complete waste of time. What does it really matter if that doctrine is true or false? That's not the heart of the issue of Mormonism. That's not really the focal point of where we need to be. So same thing with naturalism. Even though this argument might seem a little too philosophical or maybe too complex at this point, the reason I like these kind of arguments is I can just get good at one thing, keep the discussion there, kind of go straight for the jugular, if you want to use a really brutal term. But if you just pin them down on that one point, then hopefully they will quickly admit, yeah, there are elements of my worldview that are absurd. I mean, they won't say it in those terms, but it's working for me, so I'm just going to keep living my life like this. And I've been able to do that on a few occasions with atheists, and I consider that a conversational victory. So we spent a long time going through that summary, but that's okay. Does anyone have any other thoughts, ideas, comments on anything I just said? I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That is an excellent point. That's what basically every, I would say, successful false religion has done. They might even take 90% of truth, but then they just mix in this, well, it's not a little error, it's really bad. But to the untrained ear, it just sounds like, yeah, this is... it's pretty much on board. We have a few differences. Nothing major. Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, so if there's no other comments up to this point, I want to move into a topic that's similar to naturalism, and that is secularism. And part of the reason I wanted to discuss secularism is I've been having a lot of discussions about it lately with one of my work colleagues. So some of you know him. He's originally from a country that is Muslim majority. And he said, this was a discussion we've had on a few occasions, he basically has said, one of the reasons I really enjoy being in the United States is that I do not feel compelled or pressured to worship a certain way or to, you know, practice a certain religion. You know, for freedom of religion, as we would say in the United States. Whereas in his home country, there was huge pressure, huge stigma to be Muslim. And he's not a Muslim, as you can tell. So as we are discussing this, I realized, he called himself a secularist, and as I thought about this, I thought, wait a second, if your definition of secularism is really just the idea that state institutions and religious institutions should be separate, that's something I can agree with, but at the same time, in America, we typically don't use secularism to just mean that. And so I did some research, and sure enough, I found two definitions of secularism that I want to go over. So the first one is the idea that state institutions should be separate from religious institutions. And depending on how separate is defined, that's actually true. I think that's biblical. Now, if you define separate as meaning that the religious institutions can never influence the state institutions, or state institutions can never have people in them who are religious, well, obviously I would disagree with that. But if you want to just talk about the idea that, you know, a pope or a clergyman or something should not be the head of state, or there should not be some alliance between the church and state, well, I think that is biblical. And in fact, I don't know how many people here are from a Baptist background. I'm from a pretty hard-nosed Baptist background. And I remember learning about what were called Baptist distinctives back when I was a teenager. And I remember one of them that was emphasized was separation of church and state. Which always, that intrigued me at the time because I thought, wait a second, isn't this like a liberal or secular idea? Well, yeah, that, it is a secular idea. But it is taught by Scripture. Christ said, my kingdom is not of this world. And, you know, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. There is an idea presented. And in Romans 13, there's no specific mandate given that the ruler has to be a Christian. He's supposed to uphold Christian morality, I would argue, but there's no specific requirement that he has to be Christian. He is still to be obeyed. That's my understanding of those verses. Maybe somebody in here disagrees. We could have that discussion. But as I considered this definition of secularism, I thought, yeah, I can see how that's possibly biblical. The other definition, though, of secularism that I think is used more commonly, talking about the, you know, religion and politics today, is more pointed. It's the idea that, I left out a word there, the idea that religion ought to be a purely private matter and therefore shouldn't influence society in any way because it is useless or harmful. I'm just curious of your opinion. Which do you feel is the definition of secularism you have encountered the most? Or do you agree with one but not with two? Do you disagree with one and two? I'm just curious what you...
Well, just watching our people in government as they interview anybody that doesn't believe in abortion. And what they did to that one lady because she was a Catholic. It's more number two. I agree with both of them, but I think number two is the prevailing attitude of secularists.
Yeah. So I agree with you. So moving forward in this class, number two is the definition I'm going to use. When I say a secularist, I'm going to be talking about somebody who doesn't merely think that the institution should be separate, but somebody who actually has a negative view of religion and does not think it should influence politics in any way. And of course, when I use the term religion, I'm really referring to Christianity.
The word secular originates from the Latin term, which means this world.
Okay.
Secularism is a philosophical version of that sentence. There is just this world.
Okay. Okay, that's a really interesting point, and that makes complete sense. Is there anyone in here who disagrees that number one in some sense is biblical? Like, is there anyone that disagrees that the Bible teaches that state institutions and religious institutions should be separate, as again, at an institutional level? I'm not talking about influencing one another. I'm talking about like being one and the same. Is there anybody who disagrees with that, or is that something you think is biblical? I'm curious.
What's your question?
Basically, do you think number one is biblical?
It should be separate.
Yeah, state institutions and religious institutions should be separate. You think so? Okay, well, that settles it. Does anyone in here want to disagree with Pastor Doug?
No, we're not going to argue.
Okay, no.
I was just going to add that the sin cuts both ways. You know, sometimes we hear separation of church and state by number two secularists, and we get our hackles raised, but put in a bunch of, some other denominational influencers, and all of a sudden we're persecuted because we don't believe all the things that they believe.
Good point, yeah.
Well, our founding fathers, they didn't want to have a religion dominant in the government. I mean, it was freedom of religion.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's still, they wanted a separation between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So how it's defined nowadays.
Right. Yep, agreed. Okay. Okay. And
I think history shows that the practice is problematic because with dominance of institution comes power. So when religious institutions are combined with the secular political institutions, it's tended historically to have a corrupt effect.
As we definitely saw the Catholic Church. Okay, so you think it has historically been problematic, but it's not inherently wrong. Like, for example, would you say John Calvin's Geneva in Switzerland, that was, I mean, basically, I don't want to call it a theocracy, but basically there is almost no distinction between the head of state and the head of church, and something like that, aside from whether you think it was wrong that, you know, Michael Servetus got beheaded, burnt at the stake. Aside from something like that, would you say that in general that type of government or system could work?
I think they were, if I remember the history of that a long time ago, they were clearing out the abuse even during that period. But look at another alternative. Okay.
Yeah, and I. Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah. Did someone else have a?
Yeah, like Keith said, the original founding fathers, they did not want the government dictating religion. They wanted no government control over religion.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, they assumed that those people running government would be God-fearing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. Yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying. And I think a noteworthy point is that when the country was founded, 97% of the population was Protestant. And so, I've had plenty of people say America was not founded on Christian values or whatever because the Constitution doesn't specifically mention Christianity. And my response is always, look, it doesn't matter whether the Constitution specifically mentions that word. The principles therein are Christian. And most of the men who wrote the document were Christian and were inspired by Scripture, and that's the relevant point. You can't justify those ideas, again, if naturalism is true. Naturalism can't put forth any meaningful moral system. We have to get them from somewhere. We have to get them from the Bible. And we can do a whole class talking about the influence. You know, we can talk about how the founders knew that humans were sinners, and so they wanted lots of checks and balances and things like that. But probably not going to have time to do that. Go ahead.
I think there's also a distinction because obviously the state government will be run by Christ during the founding of reign. So there will be a combination of religious and secular duties during the founding of reign.
Yeah, that.
If they take over a government where there is a combination, it would be back to the other religions.
Right.
If there's someone perfect in charge, then there's no problem.
Yeah, certainly the Bible is not anti-theocracy. That's what God wanted for Israel. But Israel rejected it, and God basically gave them over to their desires and says, okay, you can get your way. Let's see how it goes. And it didn't go well. Nothing in Israel's history went well, and that was the point. That they always needed God. During the thousand-year reign, if I'm going to throw in the if you're a dispensationalist. But yeah, during the thousand-year reign, that's obviously a theocracy as well. So it's a good point. The Bible definitely is not anti-theocracy, but it's a question of whether now, in this day and age, right now, should we be promoting that, or should we be promoting this idea of separation in church and state? Okay, so that was a good discussion. We could spend the rest of the time there talking about that, but I want to move on to some other points. So here's some examples of secularism. I think that we've probably all heard in public discourse when somebody will say things like, you know, you will put forth an opinion, or someone else will put forth a Christian idea, and someone will respond with, "That's your religion, keep it to yourself." Don't let them get away with that. Please don't let them get away with that. That's just so hypocritical, really, because what they're saying, and you should point this out, is what they're really saying is keep your worldview to yourself, or keep your beliefs to yourself. Well, they have a worldview. They have beliefs. Is it just me has to keep my beliefs to myself, or is it true of you as well? Because if it's true of you as well, then this belief that you want other people to keep their beliefs to themselves, please keep that belief to yourself. Thank you. So that's the next point. Secularism is hypocrisy. It's always going to shoot itself in the foot if you take those arguments and apply it to the secularist. And again, this is something that I do all the time when I'm seeing discussion on the internet, having discussion with other people in person, wherever. By the way, there's nothing wrong with having discussions on the internet. That is a place where people interact. So sometimes you should speak up there. Obviously, the internet is notorious for devolving into, very ugly, egotistical grudge matches. But nevertheless, it can be done in wisdom. So people all the time are promoting this idea. Keep your beliefs to yourself. I had a guy tell me a couple weeks ago, stop shoving your beliefs down my throat, which again is a belief. And he was arguing for his own militant atheism. He had no problem shoving that belief down my throat. So you'll find out with secularists that they rarely want to talk about whether beliefs are actually true. They just want to keep falling back on this idea that you as a Christian need to keep your beliefs private, separate, not let them influence anything in any way. But of course, their beliefs are allowed to influence everything. That's what they're typically going to do. And again, you should not let them get away with it. You should force them to an issue of worldviews. Like, okay, no, I have my beliefs. I believe they're true. I believe they should influence society. You have your beliefs. You believe they're true. You think they should influence in society. Let's cut through the smoke. Let's actually talk about whose worldview is true. Seculars don't want to go there. That's where you should force it, because once you do, then you can start doing what? Using that two-step method I talked about, where you reduce their worldview to absurdity, you know, gently point out the contradictions, absurdities in their belief system, and then, you know, proclaim the rationality of Christianity. You had a comment? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, you know, everyone here will have the opportunity to defend Christianity even in front of a crowd, because there are a lot of people who do not realize that Christianity can be rationally defended their entire life. They've just heard this idea that, you know, it's fairy tales, or people are just believing it irrationally out of some leap of faith because it makes them feel good, or because it's a nice moral system that makes them comfortable. But in a true philosophical discussion, they have no clue or understanding of why it is rational. Yeah.
Now secularism has taken it a step further than just keep your views to yourself. They schooling.
They absolutely
want all the kids to be in the secondary
school. Yep.
They don't even agree with just keep it to yourself. They want to actually bring it a step further. So
that's a good point. And also say if there's like an arena where you can be really impactful, even if you're not into politics per se, you know, promoting homeschooling is really, really important. Because even if you don't homeschool and don't, whatever, have reasons why you don't want to homeschool, just the fact that we have that freedom is pretty amazing. If you look at, for example, Europe, where, I mean, there's been in just the recent years situations where Christians were basically persecuted in Germany for trying to educate their children in the home. And one family tried to basically flee to the United States. There was a big debacle about how the Obama administration didn't want to let them in. They didn't think that was a legitimate plea for asylum. And other people pointed out, well, I mean, this country was founded by people who were fleeing religious persecution. You know, how absurd. So, I mean, our freedom to homeschool is really, really significant. So I'll say that that is a battleground that we should fight.
Ethan, right? When Ethan was talking about the thousand-year reign, but before the thousand-year reign was the tribulation time.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, we have a one-world government and a one-world church. And to me, a lot of, the persecution that's starting to happen now is pushing the world in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, the thousand-year reign is idyllic because we have a perfect person in charge of it.
Right.
But the one-world government and homeschoolers are an absolute threat to that, totally.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, the state is not in control of their education, and I get a kick out of telling people that I went to public school every single day of my grade school life, no homeschool experience whatsoever. So I ended up, even before I had left home public school, I remember arguing with some of my English teachers over the topic and saying, I'm definitely going to homeschool my kids. And that didn't go over real well with them. But yeah, but basically I saw firsthand K through 12 granted, I was in a fairly conservative area of Pennsylvania, so I don't want to give the impression that I was, you know, every horror story you hear of where kids are being pulled from an early age that, you know, you should embrace homosexuality or the kindergarten teachers reading that book, Heather Has Two Mommies or whatever. Like, that was not my experience, but still, there's no doubt about it. Secularism was the standard. And if you brought in a Christian idea, you know, you had to defend it. You couldn't just put out a Christian idea and people were, okay, that's fine. That's a legitimate opinion. No, it would get attacked and you had to deal with it. So I saw, even before I had left, that this is not going to work for our nation if we're going to be headed in the right direction.
Well, graduating in 1965, when they were still together, you know, they taught creation, they taught evolution, the Christian values were still part of the education system. By the time I got to raising my grandson, it was still difficult to decide to homeschool.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had that influence of a decent public education, which went downhill pretty much after we graduated. Yeah.
That's actually a point I want to tie into in a second. I want to. You said there was still a time when Christian values were taught, and that ties into an argument I hear quite a bit in favor of an impetus of why we're supposed to defend Christianity in the public sphere. We'll get to that in a second. I want to talk about this real quick. The secularist takeover, we kind of already talked about it. But basically, I think we would agree that secularism has won the culture war. I don't think there's anyone who would deny that at this point. And the reason succeeded because I think is the fault of Christians. I think there's a quote, I forget who it's from, but something like, you know, every time you drive by an abortion clinic, you should just imagine a big sign out there that says, open by permission of the church. Basically, there was a time when Christians should have stepped up, should have put laws in place to stop that. And I don't want to just focus on abortion like that's the only big evil in America. There's lots of them. There's lots of injustices. I don't want to sound like that, social conservative just harping on one moral issue. But that is the classic issue. But basically, secularism succeeded in getting Christians to think you should be silent. Your religion is private. Keep it to yourself. Don't speak out about it. Don't make too big a fuss. We're doing okay doing our thing. You're doing okay doing your thing. Just leave it there. And this idea started within the church. It started in Germany in the early 19th century. That was really when theological liberalism started to develop with theologians named like Schleiermacher and Feuerbach, who were promoting this idea. Again, this is like 100 years before it came to America, but promoting this idea in Germany that Christianity doesn't necessarily have to be true. It can be a good, useful moral system that we can follow without it being true. So, you know, whether the miracles actually happened, whether Christ actually rose from the dead, that's not critical. Is basically what they argued. Christianity is ultimately just a religion of the heart, you know, not a religion of the mind. It can be divorced from reality, so to speak, and just be a private religion of the heart. And of course, that type of thinking eventually crept over throughout Europe, crept over to the United States, and you know, it erupted in the United States, like in the early 20th century, with big liberal controversy. That's when fundamentalism developed. Fundamentalism in America is usually associated with some kind of radicalism, but in Christian terms, the fundamentalists were really just people who were stepping up to theological liberals and saying, no, here's the fundamentals of the faith. Here's things you have to believe about Christianity, and if you don't believe those things, stop calling yourself a Christian. You know, the virgin birth, the resurrection, the second coming of Christ, the sufficiency of Scripture. And, of course, that term's got lumped in with other terms today. And so, you know, Islamic fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, these people are dangerous wackos when really Christian fundamentalism didn't. Yeah, that kind of thing. If you want to read a great book on that topic, actually read Christianity and Liberalism by John Gresham Machen. Very, very good book on the topic, a classic on the topic. His basically a refutation of the theological liberalism of the day. So this is one of my favorite quotes relating to apologetics. This is from the apologist John Robbins, who I quoted in the first class as well, and he made this great point. I could not agree more. Christianity, talking about in society, or even by any other opponent of Christianity, this is true of any opposing worldview adherent, Christianity is not being brilliantly attacked. It is being incompetently defended. And that's why Christians lost the culture war. So we only have 5 more minutes. I'm not going to be able to finish all of this. We'll just keep going, though. Maybe we'll continue this next week. It generated a lot of discussion, which I think is good. But I want to talk about a few of what I consider to be those incompetent defenses that Christians used over the past 100 years that did not work. The first one is, again, theological liberalism. This idea that, hey, it's not a big deal that, you know, say, people are no longer believing the historical reality of the resurrection. Christianity can just be a religion of the heart and things will be okay. As long as we just keep promoting Christian morality, we'll be fine. We don't have to promote Christianity as historical fact. That obviously did not work. But that's what theological liberals did promote, and that's what they still promote in various circles. Basically, the idea it doesn't really matter. Or basically, the idea that Christianity can just be a moral religion, and that's good enough. And of course, that's not true, and I have not been reading these as often as I should, but on the back of your handout, a lot of verses that relate to these topics. So, you know, my response to a theological liberal who promotes this idea of Christianity as a private moral religion, I mean, I would go right to Matthew 5, talking about where Christ says, "You are the salt of the earth, and you are the light of the world." And nothing about this verse indicates to me that we are supposed to keep our Christianity private. And of course, in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says, if Jesus did not rise from the dead, your faith is in vain. If you're going to hold that the resurrection of Jesus is just a secondary side issue, you know, just stop. Stop playing this game of calling yourself a Christian. You have missed the point of the gospel. You have completely missed it.
Matthew 28 falls right into that. Why would he tell us to go and disciple?
Great commission, exactly.
Yeah.
Another incompetent defense, this is, I think, was promoted a lot by, like, Barry Falwell, a lot of the well-known Christian right leaders. I hesitate to spit out names because I didn't do a lot of research here, but... Yeah, but they would call themselves the moral majority. Is that a term people have heard or familiar with? And I even saw this a lot when I was reading materials from a group called Family Research Council. I would read their bulletins back when I was a teenager. My church, Baptist church at the time, subscribed to them. And I'd pick up, you know, their bulletins, which were always lamenting how Christian influence was falling away and culture, and I'm reading their arguments and just kind of baffled because all of their arguments boil down to this real general idea that, you know, it's sad that the liberals and the political sphere are changing laws toward, you know, secularism because currently most people in America call themselves Christians and we should do what the majority wants. I'm thinking, who cares? What if 10 years from now we're not the majority? Does that make these laws any less true? Like, where's the talk about what is actually true? Not whether something's just popular or in the majority. And the reason I think so many Christians were drawn to that kind of argument is that it's uncomfortable for a lot of Christians to actually have a serious discussion about worldviews and what is true. It's a lot easier to just say, I'm in the majority, I get my way, versus... No, we should do this because the God of the universe says so. And he is the source of wisdom and not you. That's a lot more confrontational and might require some arguing, et cetera. So that was one I saw a lot promoted by, again, Christian right, whatever. Obviously did not work at all. This is probably my argument I hear that frustrates me the most is when, as an encouragement to fight against secularism, we're told that we need to return to better times in America, the good old days, return to the times when Christian values were prevalent. And that's kind of what you mentioned before. You said there was a time when Christian values were more prevalent, and there were, but at the same time... Yeah. There were still huge problems in society even back 100 years ago, 200 years ago. Like if we're gonna use this as our rally, you know, the cry that we rally around. If we're going to use this as our vanguard, our battle flag, I mean, imagine talking to you know, somebody who's experienced 200 years ago would not have been the same at ours. Like, for example, let's just say a black person. Let's go back to the good old days. Well, in the good old days, I was, you know, a slave. That doesn't sound appealing to me at all. We need to get rid of this good old days language, like there was this pristine, wonderful time in America where everything was peachy and good, and then it started to deteriorate. Every point in American history, there have been huge problems. Huge problems. And to me, Christians should be adopting the terms of progressivism. You know, we have liberals calling themselves progressives. Well, I mean, that's what we should be saying. We should be saying we're trying to progress. We're not trying to go back to some perfect time in America when everything was good. We want to progress forward to a time when God is honored, unlike any time in previous history. That's what we should be saying, in my opinion. So I really don't like that argument, that rally cry. I'm sure people here hear that quite a bit. Maybe you've even used it. I'm going to stop here. Does anyone have any final comments, agreements, disagreements before we wrap up?
Mm-hmm. He was writing to a group of very well-educated Germans,
okay,
who had been immersed for some time in a particular interpretation of the history of science, the nature of science, and what science was supposedly saying about the nature of reality. And so in that context, he thought the way to go was to reinterpret. And the problem was subsequent generations of Christians didn't keep up with the debate at that moment.
Okay. So you.
So they were overwhelmed by what was coming down the pipe in the name of science, which was really a philosophical interpretation of what was going on.
That's an interesting point. I'd like to talk to you more about that. That's an interesting point. Okay, thank you everyone for your discussion. This was some really good discussion today. We'll might continue this discussion next week, or we might move on. But thank you for coming. As always, if you have any more questions, feel free to talk to me afterward.